Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 152, recorded Sunday, June 16th, 2019. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: overwhelmed by travel and restaurant trends. So coming to you today from the new Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, the move from the suburban studio down to the city studio went surprisingly smooth. Maybe some clothes, some old shirts, somehow I just found out kind of seemed to have been lost, but really nothing got destroyed on that 20-mile trip in from the western suburbs. I have the production bay rebuilt and now trying out the new studio setup, so we'll see how this sounds. Which also means I haven't done much travel since the last episode, just a quick trip down to Nashville. But the move downtown meant I had to rethink some of my travel patterns, not how to get to and from Nashville, but how to get to and from Chicago Midway Airport. I mean, we've said before in many episodes, most, maybe all, frequent travelers are all about optimizing the standard parts of their journey. What's the most efficient way to get to the airport? When to leave? Optimizing the trade-off, say, between sleep and getting to the gate when status pre-boarding is announced. In the old digs, I had a pretty predictable sort of 25-30 minute drive to either O'Hare or Midway and a long-term relationship with a dependable driver, which meant answering the when do I need to leave for the airport question was a pretty mindless exercise, which is exactly what I wanted it to be. Subtract 90 minutes from the departure time, send a text to my guy the night before. But now it's a kind of predictable 60-minute public transit ride or a very unpredictable 35 to 60-minute Uber-Lyft ride with even more unpredictable wait times and surge pricing, especially when catching a morning flight. And actually, for this three-day trip to Nashville, I actually think it would have been cheaper to drive and park, even with the city of Chicago's latest parking taxes. The Southwest flights between Midway and Nashville were a bit odd because the pilot kept everyone in their seats for the entire flight due to unexpected turbulence, of which, honestly, I really didn't feel any. Though I thought it was interesting that the pilot on our return trip said, "We may ask our flight attendants to remain seated so we can fly faster and pick up some time." I actually think that pilot really there was sort of uncorking the truth of the matter. It's an hour and 20-minute flight, so not too long to stay seated, as long as you, say, didn't drop a couple of beers at the bar right before boarding. But it also meant I didn't get a chance to use some of the free drink coupons that Southwest had sent me last month. I guess I should have followed the advice on a Nashville airport billboard that was posted right above our Southwest gate. It said, "Before wheels up, whiskey up." Following up, because the trip to Nashville was personal travel, I used award points where I could. Hyatt for our hotel and Hertz for the rental car. And the only reason I didn't use Southwest points was because I was burning off a $100 customer satisfaction certificate that Southwest sent me as a comp for one of the three, I don't know which one, but one of the three delayed flights that I had that one day when I was going Chicago to Vegas, back to Nashville by way of Houston Hobby. I talked about that in the Travel Interruptus episode a couple of months ago. That was Act One of Travel Interruptus. So we've talked about how to use awards many times over the past years. And while the tactics may change a bit, my overall strategy has been pretty consistent. Use them rather than save them, or earn and burn, as some folks say. Now, I know a lot of travelers will save award points, hoard them, thinking of them as their travel savings account, or perhaps a badge of honor. I have 2 million American Airlines points, to which I think, and try not to say, that are going to get you a lot less the longer you keep holding on to them. Because rather than increasing in value by earning interest, they can suddenly decrease value when, say, United or British Airways or Marriott, or a couple of weeks ago, actually Hertz, decide to redo their awards charts. And all those lovely words in the announcements about increasing the value of their program, I've never seen one of those changes actually increase the value of the points. At the end of May, Hertz published, without any warning or announcement, a new chart that increased the point cost for daily and weekly rentals by somewhere between 11 and 36%, depending upon their award. Now, back in March, Marriott added a new top hotel category with a 42% higher per night award cost, 85,000 points a night for the properties that moved into the new Category 8 versus 60,000 points when they were in 7. And, of course, most of the properties that got that 42% bump were resort properties, the ones you'd most likely want to use your points on. And coming up in November, United will eliminate their awards charts altogether following Delta and Southwest in moving to dynamic pricing, which inevitably means a depreciation of United points. So, I don't know, pick your slogan, earn and burn, use them or lose them. Though I think I like the you deserve a break today better, meaning plan a vacation and burn your points before those companies do. Now, even though I haven't traveled much since the last episode, I've still been thinking a lot about travel, specifically laying out our trip next week, a week in Ireland and then heading over to Scotland for Claire's graduation from University of St. Andrews. Now, I talked in the last episode about wrestling with the Avios website to book our flights, but with that done, I got consumed by packing and moving and unpacking the house and the apartment, and quite honestly, just sort of lost track of the other reservations that we needed for our week in Ireland. Now, that insight, that revelation landed on me pretty hard the Tuesday after Memorial Day when I was looking at my calendar and started seeing June dates. Honestly, I had nothing. No car, no places to sleep. And it's not like the end of June is low season in Ireland. Now, back in March, in episode 149, I talked about how we dug deep when planning our spring break trip to Brittany, buying guidebooks, scouring websites, but we had never been there before. Now, my planning for Ireland has been a lot more impromptu because back in the early 90s, I spent a lot of time in Cork for business. And while the country has no doubt changed a lot in the past 20 some odd years, I had kind of a sense of what I wanted to see and a bit of an itinerary in mind, spending most of the week hubbing out of Galway, going south down to County Clare and then north up into the Connemara in County Galway, and then heading over to Dublin for the last weekend before flying out to Edinburgh. So I found myself spending most of my time spelunking through TripAdvisor, first in the Ireland forum, trying to figure out the right rental car strategy. My default strategy, go with Hertz and leverage my U.S. status if anything goes sideways, didn't seem like it would work because Hertz has franchised its name to, in Ireland to another company. Also, rental car insurance seems to be a bit unique in Ireland. Using your credit card to cover damages like I did on my last trip to St. Andrews apparently requires a letter from your card issuer and is still a particular hassle at the counter. And then there was the sifting through the Manichaean universe of TripAdvisor reviews, that sort of bipolar split between five-star, everything is fantabulous, and the one-star, it's a complete dumpster fire, and I'm sure the maid spit in my water glass sort of write-ups. I tend to be actually more at the forgiving end of that spectrum. I don't think you should slam a place for a problem if you didn't tell them about it and give them a chance to fix it. I also try and have reasonable expectations. You're not going to get psychic sort of, you know, transcendent levels of service for $100 a night. At the end of it, it took me a solid day and a half of screen time, but now actually we do have a bed for each night and a set of wheels to get us to them. Being off the road for a month, though, helped me drop a nagging sort of 7 to 8 pounds that I put on over the Christmas holidays, and until now, 5 to 6 months later, just have not been able to drop. We talked about in past episodes how easy it is to put weight on when traveling, eating 3 meals a day in restaurants, or worse, when you're on the run in airports, makes portion control difficult. It's also difficult to, you know, eat more vegetables and fries. But even when you've chosen, say, the fish instead of the burger, you're still, you know, at someone's mercy for how it's cooked. Now, this light bulb lit for me while watching The Chef Show on Netflix over the weekend. It's a great cooking show. It stars Jon Favreau, who's the director of the Iron Man movies, and Roy Choi, who was one of the first gourmet food truck guys in L.A. You track down Roy's food truck on Twitter for his fantastic sort of Korean-Mexican tacos. He's one of the first guys who did that fusion cuisine. Apparently, these guys worked together on Favreau's Chef movie a couple of years back, and they got together for this Netflix series. In the second episode, they're cooking in Atlanta with Ford Fry at his restaurant, The Optimist, and they're making a shrimp toast dish that easily uses over a stick of butter to cook and sauce just 5 large shrimp. They joke about the amount of butter and salt restaurants use. When they say no salt, Favreau asks Choi. Choi responds, "We add twice as much." And then they go and add another half stick of butter to the shrimp pan. I'm sure it tastes great, but actually it was kind of an aha moment to me. How, even when you think you're ordering healthy, the guys in the back are focused on taste, not counting calories for you. Now, after our move, I've cranked through most of the address changes, but still haven't done my driver's license. But that one is going to take a little bit more work because my current Illinois driver's license isn't a real ID license. It doesn't have the gold star in the upper right corner. Now, that's not a problem now, but in 16 months from now, October 2020 to be exact, the TSA says it will fully enforce the 2005 Real ID Act, for real this time, no more extensions, we're serious, and in doing that will no longer accept non-compliant, non-real ID IDs, trying to say that 3 times fast, at airports. Now, getting a real ID license requires more documentation, proof of my social security number and 2 documents with my new address, like utility bill or a bank statement, which could be a bit of a challenge now that we got most everything, most billing, most bank statements, we all get electronically. Now, I could just skip it and use my passport or my global entry card if I can find it. It's in a box somewhere, I think, I hope. But I could use one of those instead. But that would mean I'd have to actually remember to bring one more thing to me to the airport, which is never a best practice. Now, it's not critical. I got 16 months to get around to it, though probably not something I want to wait until the last minute on. The Illinois DMV isn't the quickest, most nimble organization on its best days. I can only imagine what it'll be like come, say, August or September 2020, when it gets crushed with people without passports looking to swap their driver's license before that October 1st, 2020 deadline. And hey, if you've got any stories, questions, comments, tips, gripes, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio comments to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can post your comments on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is overwhelmed by travel. So Christine Danielson, a longtime friend but a first-time Travel Commons listener, asked me after listening to the last episode, "I'd love to hear how you get acclimatized to a new city from the moment you leave the gate. I always feel overwhelmed." You know, I have to tell you, that question pulled me up short. I've never really thought about it that way. I mean, I've been traveling heavily coming on 35 years. I've been traveling longer than I haven't been traveling, I guess, if I do the math, because I'm not 70 years old. I started traveling, I think, when I was too young and seemingly indestructible to know any better. And now I have enough travel experience, routines, rhythms, patterns, I called them at the start of the show, and of course, status, that even when gutting through something like the whole Travel Interruptus story a couple episodes ago, things will seem more inconvenient for me than overwhelming. I think one of the most important things for me is having enough money in my pocket to handle what could come my way. Now, at the end of the last century, the 1990s to be exact, I was doing a lot of bunny hop trips through Europe. Sweden one day, Switzerland the next, then Germany, then the UK. Now, this was pre-ATMs, pre-Euro, pre-mobile phones, and for many places in Europe, pre-widespread acceptance of credit cards. I mean, truly, the travel dark ages. So my routine would be to exit customs, head straight to the currency exchange, cash a $100 Amex American Express traveler's check, so I would have enough local cash for, I don't know, say a coffee, a cab. Having that cash in my pocket settled me a bit. I don't know, maybe it gave me a sense of some control, no matter how illusionary that may have been. Today, I'll head straight for an ATM instead of the currency exchange. And as I said a couple episodes back, I make sure I have a full house of credit cards, a Visa and MasterCard from different banks and an Amex card. And it's not just when I'm out of the country. Even in the U.S., I'm a lot more comfortable traveling when I've got sort of 5 or 10 20s in my wallet. Now, after my wallet comes the phone. I mean, modern travel is all about the smartphone app. Is my plane on time? Where's the hotel? What train line do I need? You know, that whole Travel Interruptus tale would have been much worse than inconvenient without smartphone connectivity. I wouldn't have been able to tweet at Southwest customer service to understand when my delayed flight was going to be leaving. I wouldn't have been able to find a decent hotel in Paris when the train delays in Rennes made us miss our flight home to Chicago, and I wouldn't have been able to book that god-awfully expensive Uber that got us to Charles de Gaulle just in time that following Tuesday to make our flight home after the train line just magically stopped and dumped us out onto a curb somewhere. Back in that last century, I probably would have searched for a payphone, pulled out my phone card, and rung up the travel agency. I mean, even today, if I'm ringing up a travel agency instead of doing it on my own, you know, when was the last time you actually saw a working payphone? So those are sort of some of the thoughts around mechanics of travel. But what about fitting in to the place when you've arrived? I've talked about in the past about how business travelers tend to float above everything in sort of a travel bubble. You walk out, you know, in baggage claim, and you find somebody holding a sign with your name whose job is to give you a bottle of water and whisk you past the things that might be disconcerting or overwhelming. When that bubble pops unexpectedly and drops you into the day-to-day reality of the place you are, that decompression can be overwhelming. The closest I came to an overwhelming experience was not when I was arriving in a place, but actually when I was trying to leave. A colleague and I had wrapped up our day in Pune, India, and were flying home from Mumbai that night, but on different flights, his leaving a couple hours earlier than mine. And for some reason, and I had missed this when I first looked at the itinerary, there you go, there's a pro tip, look at your, you know, read your itinerary closely. For some reason, that person who was arranging the trip had us taking cars, a driver from Pune to Mumbai instead of flying. Well, okay. And it wasn't that bad of a drive. Actually, it was, you know, it was a bit scenic right up until we hit Mumbai traffic. And so we get to the international terminal. We pull our bags from the trunk, make our way through the general sort of chaos of people and push carts and food vendors to the entrance. Now, we both have our itineraries out and ready for inspection. My colleague goes first. The officer looks at his itinerary, waves him through. I hand over my itinerary, follow my colleague, except I can't. I can't go into the terminal. I'm too early. Now, if I had flown from Pune to Mumbai, this wouldn't have been a problem because I would have been making a connection between terminals. But with the drive, I can't get into the terminal. I'm too early. Now I'm back out in the chaos with no place to go. Our car is long gone. I have no idea where Mumbai Airport is in relationship to anything. I mean, is there a hotel nearby? What's here? And I don't have a working mobile phone to ring anyone. I'm just standing around with hundreds of other people who are trying to get in or saying goodbye to someone trying to get in or waiting for somebody to come out. I walked up and down the sidewalk in front of the terminal looking for something, a phone, a bench. I find a door. I look in. It's a lounge for people waiting for arriving passengers. And then there's this big floor-to-ceiling plexiglass wall separating that lounge from baggage claim. So when you're, when the person you're picking up shows up, you can kind of wave at each other. There's actually even a little phone that you could talk to the person on the other side of the plexiglass wall. So, I mean, it was nice. And more importantly, it had seats, it was air-conditioned, and it had a restroom. I walk in, except I can't. I need a ticket. Where do I get that? Back out and around the corner. So I find the ticket window. It's a couple of hundred rupees, $2 to $3. No credit cards accepted. But I reach into my pocket and I pull out my last bit of cash, a 500 rupee note. And then things got a lot less overwhelming. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is restaurant trends. Last month, I hit the National Restaurant Association's annual show in Chicago's McCormick Place Convention Center. I mean, if you need reminding of how big the restaurant business is in the U.S., this show was huge. I was interested to see what's new and what has actually stayed the same since the last time I went to the show about 4 years ago. What's new? I was walking the aisles. I was immediately struck by the number of booths showing delivery containers, and they were just everywhere. Talking to a couple of vendors, they said some hotels are seeing huge growth in DoorDash and Grubhub deliveries, that they're eating into their restaurant and room service revenues. All puns intended there. And since they're seeing it being driven by the new generation of travelers, the millennial and Gen Z travelers, they actually think it's more of a trend than a blip, yet another revenue stream lost to traveler technology, like when they lost long-distance phone calls to cell phones and then pay TV revenues to PCs and iPads running Netflix and YouTube. So many of the hotels, they said, especially the lower-end ones, are actually dropping food service altogether. But all these delivery cartons, and now this growth in delivery cartons, collides with sustainability concerns. You got a growth in now styrofoam containers and plastic bags. So I'd walk past, say, two booths back to back, the first selling traditional containers, the second pushing compostable paper and bioplastics. Compostable and bioplastic containers look good, except actually when I tried to use a paper straw on a frozen margarita sample that somebody pushed on me. That, I tell you, that one was a complete fail. Luckily, I don't drink frozen drinks that much, but that is a place I think you still need a plastic. I also saw a number of sort of established ethnic food companies trying to branch out into newer, sort of hotter ethnic spaces. Kronos, for example, is one of the main companies selling Greek gyros meat. In their booth, they were certainly sampling their gyros, but also they had a new chicken al pastor, so Mexican, and then Korean beef barbecue. Cultural appropriation or trying to stay in business by catering to those darn millennial and Gen Zers? I don't know, but the Kronos guy told me actually that 90% of their business still comes from the gyros, which kind of rang true when I was looking at sample booths that had the longest lines. Hot dogs from Vienna Beef and Nathan's and grilled cheese sandwiches from Tillamook Cheddar. That being said, there were a lot of vendors selling Asian products, primarily Japanese and Korean, continuing the trend that I had seen in the the show in the past. Digital is still big, but the focus seemed to have shifted from smartphone apps to being able to interface with those upcoming delivery services, being able to easily update their menus and getting orders automatically flowing through the delivery services into the restaurant's point of sale systems, and then also more efficiently managing social media. I saw a Yelp booth for the first time at the show. It was really a good-sized booth, nicely carpeted with tables full of phones running their app, but it was pretty empty, mostly populated by Yelp employees. It gave me a good idea of how all those restaurateurs were rating Yelp's booth. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast number 152. I hope you all enjoyed the show. Hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. As always, you can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, and Spotify. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram sites. If you've already subscribed, do me a favor and leave us a review on one of those sites. And if you've already done that, thank you very much. And as always, if you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter. Put them on the Travel Commons Facebook page, on the Instagram site, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. So about ready to head over, as I said earlier, head over to Ireland and then to Scotland, be there through the rest of the month. So until we talk again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.